You are listening to the Doug Hagman Radio Show, weekdays 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And now the man behind the mic, a private investigator with over 30 years under his belt, Doug Hagman.
Good morning, everyone. It's 6 a.m. on the west coast of America, 9 a.m. here in the east. Welcome to Hagman. It's the Doug Hagman Investigative Hour for today, Wednesday, October 17th, 2018. Day 636 from the Donald J. Trump presidency, 20 days to the midterms. That's right. A couple of news items. I want to get into something here that I've been getting some emails from listeners to our flagship show and even listeners to this show about doing a program about how we got here. Now, I know that sounds, oh, come on. Would you get off the deep dive stuff already? Just talk about stuff that's current to where to what's going on today. Yeah, this is all part of what's going on today. All right. And this explains a lot. How we got here explains what's really a look back at the past will reveal, in my view, what is just ahead in the future. You know, the saying on the rear view or side view mirrors of your vehicle, objects in the mirror are closer than they appear, is really kind of ominously correct in a metaphorical sense, I suppose, in this case anyway. A couple of things. Obviously, YouTube went down last night, went dark for more than an hour Tuesday night, affecting users across the globe. The YouTube is a subsidiary of Google. Now, they acknowledged the outage in a tweet after users began posting about it on other social media platforms. The reports contained in The Hill. The company tweeted at 9:41, that's p.m., by the way, Eastern Time. Thanks for your reports about YouTube, and YouTube Music across the access issues. We're working on resolving this, and we'll let you know once it's fixed. We apologize for any inconveniences. And we'll keep you updated. Well, followers were notified about an hour later that the website was up and running again. The company tweeted at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, "We're back. Thanks for your patience. If you continue to experience issues, please let us know." Now, YouTube did not indicate why the site went down. Who knows? The AP contacted YouTube. They said, "We don't have anything to add beyond the tweet." Hey, by the way, if you're in the mood, Powerball highlight or jackpot highlights day two lottery fever. Yeah, if you didn't win the Mega Millions jackpot, don't despair. You've got another chance today at being crazy rich. Yeah, today's Powerball drawing is worth an estimated $345 million, with the cash a cool $199 million. I just look at that as kind of a tax on the stupid. I'm sorry. Okay, I don't do lotteries. I don't gamble. Gambling to me, not because I'm morally against it, because it's just a bad practice. Why would you? I don't quite get the mindset behind that, and I don't get the mindset behind when it's up to $199 million or $345 million. You gotta buy a ticket. Do you? I mean, maybe I'm not seeing something others are. But I just look at every dollar that I have, and I operate. And maybe this is good to let people know. The Hagman Report, the Doug Hagman Radio Show, we accept listener and viewer contributions, support. In fact, we operate almost solely on the support of our listeners and viewers. Now, you might say, "Well, you've got sponsors, you've got advertisers." Well, yeah, but trust me when I say that it's not very much. I mean, look, it doesn't. That doesn't even cover the cost of our monthly internet service, to be honest with you. But it's something. It's something that you can't afford to turn down. Okay. But the way I look at gambling or buying a lottery ticket would be, in my view, a misuse of those people who support us. If we derive our income from the people who support us, would it not be an insult to those people for us to buy lottery tickets or us to go into a casino and gamble? Oh, look, I've been in casinos. I've played craps. And in fact, I've enjoyed it. Okay. I've done it before. I've done it in the past. But I've won and I've lost. Actually, craps was my favorite casino game. And still is, by the way, but okay. If you play it properly, you know, you can have an edge. But in the end, the adage, the house always wins. Believe me, that's the truth. But aside from that, the lotto fever, you see lines of people lined up outside of bodegas in New York and stores, you know, really? You're going to wait 10, 15, 20 minutes to buy a lottery ticket for this small chance of winning? I mean, beyond small. Hey, but I guess you got to play to win, so whatever the mindset is. But again, my philosophy, my personal philosophy, how I operate the Hagman Report, how I operate the Doug Hagman Radio Show, is I don't play the lottery. Now, just to be clear, maybe my wife would buy one ticket once in a while. All right. So, you know, and she often does that. Maybe, you know, a dollar for a ticket if the jackpot's up really high. But that's her. That's not me. And she does it without telling me, you know, and it's something, it's kind of like a wink, wink, nod, nod secret. But my philosophy is no. We are good. We attempt to be good stewards with the money that we receive. And by the way, if you haven't caught the flagship show, speaking of that, there are desperate people in Florida. We are helping the Hagman Report as well as the Doug Hagman Radio Show and the Dispatch together combined are helping the Oath Keepers and American Survival Wholesale. What they are doing, they've combined efforts. American Survival Wholesale is shipping food, and I'm talking about canned goods as well as ready-to-eat food, on pallets from their warehouse in Texas to Pensacola, Florida. In fact, a pallet left 2 days ago. Should arrive today, according to everything I've seen. And there, on this pallet are 10,100 servings of food. The shipping alone is $3,000. The cost of the food is another, it's over. The entire cost is pretty close to $15,000. All right, now Chance had said 10, but there are other factors involved too. So he's undercutting, understating the cost. So the bottom line is this: we are looking to assist, and we are assisting American Survival Wholesale and the Oath Keepers, and our listeners and viewers and the people, great people in Florida, by making sure they get food delivered to them. So if you have the opportunity, I ask you, if you're listening to this and you've got a few extra bucks, put it toward the victims in Florida. All you have to do, now write this email address down, or just remember, go to AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com and click on the button there. Navigate, find the donate button for the hurricane victims. But the PayPal address is bugoutamerica@usa.com. That's bugoutamerica@usa.com. And again, we are assisting them. We want to see really 50,000 shipments at least of food going out to the victims of the hurricane. And do me a favor, put a note there that's saying that you heard it from Hagman. Only because, not for credit, or the people listening to this are going to say, oh, you just want credit. No. It's about our reach, and it's about keeping track of how we're doing, essentially. That's all. Are we making a difference? Because I want to know if we're making a difference. And there's nothing wrong with that. So, but yeah, just put a note. Heard it on Hagman. So I really appreciate that. Because there are people hurting down there whose lives have just been torn apart, upended by this hurricane. Well, you know. So That's what I wanted to say about that. Another news item here I've been following, and these are off the radar. Joseph Arpaio, Sheriff Joe, who I've spoken to quite extensively, and when I was in Washington, D.C. In fact, I've got a photograph of Joe and I together. We were talking, and then there's one a deliberate pose. But anyway, the former Maricopa County Sheriff, Joe Arpaio, is filing a libel suit against the New York Times and a member of its editorial board. Now, Arpaio is seeking $147.5 million in damages over a Times op-ed by Michelle, what's her last name, Caudill, titled, "Well, at least Sheriff Joe isn't going to Congress." Now, Arpaio says that the piece contains several false, defamatory, factual assertions. And this complaint was filed with the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Arpaio claims that the article was carefully and maliciously calculated to damage and injure his reputation. Now, all of the accounts in Caudill's piece have been previously reported, including stories about prisoners in jails overseen by Arpaio being beaten, mistreated, humiliated. I guess that's a subjective phrase, but okay. He was convicted, by the way. Just so people know, Arpaio was convicted of criminal contempt by a federal court in 2017. But President Trump pardoned him before he could be sentenced. And we spoke about this briefly. I spoke to him about this. I don't have much further to say about this, except looking at the situation as it happened. I have to stand with Joe Arpaio on this, only because I know the backstory, and I don't have his permission, nor do I think it's really relevant to get into the backstory, except to say the media is weaponized against any conservative, against you and I, and frankly, you and I can find ourselves in a similar position. When I say this, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding, because myself, you know, the out-of-pocket funds I've had to spend for, just to protect my reputation of malicious and libelous and slanderous claims. I mean, my goodness, it's a war out there. The latest, I couldn't believe what I was reading. Okay, you know, when someone knocks on your door and hands you a piece of paper. Anyway, now I'm a misogynist, in addition to being a Russian agent, in addition to being someone who destabilized the 2016, or was part of a plot to destabilize America and throw the 2016 elections to President Trump in favor of the Russians, of course. But see, the only reason I bring this up, and I guarantee you, see, later today I'll get a phone call from my attorney saying, "What are you doing? You shut up." You know, I mean, it's just, but okay. Can you tell my frustration? But the weaponization process right now is so severe. The weaponization against all of us, against you and I. Look at Twitter. Look at Facebook. Look at all the socials. Arbitrarily banning conservative websites in advance of the 2016 elections. Now, we are still unbanned on Twitter, or uncensored, or we still have a platform on Twitter. We still have a platform on Facebook, personally and professionally, Hagman Report, Douglas Hagman. I've got that. But see, and as I mentioned in one of the earlier programs this week, yeah, shadow banning, you can post something, but no one sees it, or very few people see it. It's like yelling for help in an abandoned field. No one's going to hear you. And that's the intent of this utopian left. So, which brings me to the point of this program. How in the world do we get here? Now, I beg for your indulgence here. Just stay with me, because this will, I say this all of the time, but I really believe you will see. And I've kind of planned this program out pretty tightly. So I think you'll see in the end how this ties together. And I think I'll have enough time to really drive this point home. So, okay. I would suggest, by the way, anyone out there interested in really understanding these elitists, these central planners, these globalists, these, I don't call them what you will, members of the so-called deep state, permanent state, the SES, the permanent bureaucracy, to understand what's going on. We had a guest on not too long ago. I mean, this year, an author by the name of William J. Murray. He wrote a book, just a fantastic book, Utopian Road to Hell. The subtitle, Elitist Enslaving the World with Central Planning. Now, William Murray is just a fantastic author, I believe. He's a great author. Now, we had a guest on, and I had gotten emails, so many emails from younger people, and I'm glad I'm getting emails from younger people asking about a comment made about Woodrow Wilson. And I'll just distill the totality of the emails down into a phrase or into a one sentence question. What in the world does Woodrow Wilson have to do with what's going on today? Well, okay. Yeah. Answer that in a sentence. Well, here's the deal. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lay out the foundation of where we are today, meticulously, and citing, as a source, of course, William Murray's book, but also, more importantly, my own personal studies and research. When I say more importantly, I mean, I'm making this my own through my interpretation and my research and my investigation of where we are and the individuals who are declaring war on you and I, who are attempting to silence us across social media. If I say, for example, social media or censorship if censorship is the tool, shadow banning the tool that's being used by the deep state operatives, well, and censorship, of course, of the truth or of what or of conservative ideology or opinions that lean conservative or lean right or lean Republican, if that's an important aspect, and I dare say it is, along with the weaponization of the social media platforms, the weaponization of the media, the weaponization of politics, that is to say the attempt to take down Donald Trump by any means necessary, whether it's through impeachment, should the Democrats win the House and Senate in the midterms to whatever else they can throw at the conservatives and the president. If that's important, well, who's doing it and what are their roots? Know your enemy. Know your enemy. So taking a deep dive into things, I'm going to toss a name out here. Colonel Edward Mandel House. Colonel, of course, is a designation used in the military and paramilitary organizations, but in this case, it's just a air quote honorary title, Edward Mandel House. How many people, show of hands, how many people know Edward Mandel House? Well, you might know the name. All right. Who is this guy? He played a key role in the administration of Woodrow Wilson, the president, early part of the 20th century, especially in foreign policy during and after World War I. Now, I'm going to toss another name out there to you. Edward Bellamy. Okay, two names that you should know. Edward Bellamy. He was a socialist utopian who wrote Looking Backward. He wrote that book in 1887. Now, these two guys had an enormous and historically disastrous impact on what we see today. Trust me, I've got a point, and I'm getting to it, and I will get to it and wrap it up by the end of the program. Colonel House, or Edward Mandel House, he was a political operative from Texas. He was educated at a New England prep school as a lad, and later studied at Cornell University back in 1877. He was forced to quit when his father died. He returned to Texas to run his father's cotton plantations and banking interests and such, and he inherited a great deal of money. He was super rich. And in Texas, he became this pseudo-politician. He used his abilities to manipulate people to help Democrats win governor races. He was deep into politics. But he himself never sought political office or government appointment. Consider him, and William Murray kind of does this, references this way in his book. Consider Edward Mandel House the Karl Rove to Woodrow Wilson. You get it now? All right. And he became really rich, mostly from inheritance. But anyway, House's father, Edward Mandel House's father. Hey, I see you reaching for the button. Don't turn me off here, because again, this all goes to what's happening today. Now, House's father was he made a killing in the Civil War. House's father died in 1880. He left his five kids just $500,000, I believe it was, at least in today's currency. But anyway, lived in Austin, Texas, and think about that. Think of how Austin is in the red state of Texas. You've got this blue stronghold in Austin. Well, you've got to go back to the roots, and Edward Mandel House was a fixture in Austin. Anyway, yeah, I'm getting to it. In 1912, he, under a pen name, Edward Mandel House, published a utopian novel titled Philip Drew, Administrator, A Novel of Tomorrow, 1920 to 1935. Now, of course, the colon is a colon, not Philip Drew, Administrator, A Novel of Tomorrow, 1920 to 1935. It sucked as a book, but what it did was it explained House's utopian communist vision, the vision of a benevolent dictator. Now, I want you to think about this in terms of not Donald Trump, but in terms of Obama's 8 years, all right? So anyway, when he lived in New York, House spent summers near Boston or in Europe, and don't underestimate how much of an impact European culture has in America today. Just saying. But he had some high-powered friends, including J.P. Morgan at the time. Anyway, during this time of his life, he was making, through his investments and his whatever, about $500,000 equivalent to today. Now, Edward Mandel House, or Colonel Edward Mandel House, had this dream for America to become a communist nation under a benevolent dictator. And he latched on to Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, who had been elected governor of New Jersey back in 1910. And they had mutual friends and such. Anyway, they got hooked up together. And the House eventually became this advisor to Woodrow Wilson, and deserves a lot of credit for Wilson being nominated and later elected president of the United States in 1912. Again, Edward Mandel House, the Karl Rove to Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, back in the day. So, Wilson, acknowledging the fact that Colonel Edward Mandel House played such a great role, he offered him any cabinet post he wanted, except for Secretary of State, which he had promised to William Jennings Bryan. House, now he said, look, I want to be in the shadows. I want to work in the shadows. I want to deal with players and policies. I want to just shape stuff. It was Edward Mandel House, for example, who lobbied for and ultimately was rewarded for his efforts by the creation of the Federal Reserve, what we know today, the Federal Reserve. You want to know who started the Federal Reserve? It was the idea, the brain trust of Colonel Edward Mandel House, the Karl Rove of the Woodrow Wilson administration. He was also involved in the formation of both the graduated income tax that we are using today, and in 1921, the Council on Foreign Relations. Oh, okay, now. So we trace this all the way. So the creation of the Fed, graduated income tax, and the establishment, at least the thought for the establishment of the Council on Foreign Relations, Edward Mandelhaus. The CFR had been referred to, of course, as this invisible government. Yep. Has it changed? Of course not. And its members, of course, of the CFR had played key roles in numerous administrations since its formation. Now, Edward Mandelhaus began pushing for an end to America's neutrality in the war that was going on in Europe. This, again, go back to the early 19-teens, okay? Anyway, now, as part of the process, he began preaching preparedness, which including building up of our army, our navy. Remember, up to this point, America, at least in theory, was a non-interventionist nation. In 1916, Wilson won re-election with the campaign slogan, "He kept us out of war." Now, you may not know this or whatever, but, you know, up until that time, we were neutral on the, we were not involved in anything that has now become known as World War I and the conflicts leading up to that. But behind the scenes, this Edward Mandelhaus was pushing for us to get involved in the war. Now, his efforts were ultimately successful, and shortly after his election to a second term, that is Woodrow Wilson, Wilson asked Congress for a declaration of war. House bragged in one of his daily diary entries that I began with him before he became president. I have never relaxed my efforts. At every turn, I have stirred his ambition to become the great liberal leader of the world. Now, this is a great, great reference, I believe, to this narcissistic kind of mentality of House, but also it applies today. You can see it in congressional Senate leaders of today. All right. Now, as World War I started, it kind of was winding down, this Edward Mandelhaus was making a way for Wilson to take a key role in the peace process. And again, House was manipulating Wilson. Think Karl Rove, George Bush. This is House to Wilson. And Wilson accepted House's proposal to assemble a group of foreign policy experts who worked on what was called the inquiry. This became the basis for Wilson's 14 points and for his proposals for the Versailles Peace Conference, the Versailles Peace Treaty. And one of those 14 points was the establishment, the creation of a League of Nations. Now, House served as Wilson's chief negotiator during the peace negotiations between 17 and 19. That's 1917, 1919. All right. Now, when you look at the, if you go to sources like encyclopedic sources, he helped draft the Treaty of Versailles, the covenant of the League of Nations. Now, more conciliatory and realistic than Wilson at the peace conference, his friendship with Wilson ended in 1919 because of conflict in the conduct of the negotiations. Now, House was a strong advocate for the League of Nations, as well as the World Court, known as the Permanent Court of International Justice. Colonel Edward Mandelhaus, he was perfectly willing to submerge American sovereignty under the authority of the League and World Court. What do we see today? The attempt to subjugate America as a nation under global governance. This is the basis of everything we see today. You've got Woodrow Wilson, who was acting up until 1919, having the Karl Rove of that day shaping foreign policy and willing to subjugate America, the nation, under a global government system. The same tactic or the same goals that we see today by the modern so-called, in quotation mark, progressive liberal sellouts of our nation. And then we saw Donald Trump come in, upset that apple cart, because one of the biggest, aside from Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, in my particular opinion, the only president, if you would call him that, given his lack of bona fides, to even come close to Wilson was Barack Hussein Obama in terms of selling America out to global interests. So, and you've heard Ted Brewer talk about the Treaty of Versailles and such, and the Treaty of Versailles included numerous provisions dealing with disarmament, very harsh on Germany. It took actually 13.5% of Germany's 1914 territory and all of its overseas possessions. It limited the German army, banned the use of heavy artillery, tanks, aircraft. The German Navy was also diminished and restricted. The reparations demanded of Germany, were astronomical and actually led to hyperinflation in Germany and the rise of Adolf Hitler. So it can be argued, and I think accurately so, that Hitler rose to power based on the treatment of Germany from the Treaty of Versailles, which was hammered out by Edward Mandelhaus under the Wilson administration. All right. And talking about a fascist, obviously, a national socialist. Don't forget, Hitler was a national socialist. National socialist. That's lost on many people, especially throwing accusations of the phrase Nazi or term Nazi at conservatives today. Now, this is important to understand, because when you look at the Treaty of Versailles, it demanded that Germany pay back, if you would put it in today's figures, some $400 billion for the damages it caused during the war. In fact, Germany did not pay off its last installment of the reparations until 8 years ago, 2010. So think about that. Anyway, now, again, the Treaty of Versailles ultimately gave birth to Adolf Hitler and the National Socialist Movement. So just to wrap up Hauser, in 1935, I want to mention some high points, and this is one of them. Edward Mandelhaus published an article that showed his support for Mussolini, actually Mussolini's fascist objectives in Africa, to be specific. And he wrote, in part, "The tension in Europe will lead to new disasters unless the imperial urge of Mussolini has the opportunity to spend itself on African soil." Read into that what you will, but the bottom line, I believe he was supporting Mussolini's fascist objectives. Now, Edward Mandelhaus died in 1938, obviously long before the Nazi machinery was unleashed in Germany and across the world. But at the bottom line is, he is at least partially responsible for the Versailles Treaty, at least from the American standpoint, and ultimately the rise of Hitler. All right, now full stop there. The meat, I suppose, the meat of Edward Mandelhaus, his alter ego, Philip Drew, D-R-U. As I mentioned earlier, Edward Mandelhaus wrote a book, Philip Drew, Administrator. Many people know it, and I think it's available online. But in this book, House described the life and totalitarian philosophy of the fictional Philip Drew, a West Point graduate who had a disdain for free enterprise system. Sound familiar? A disdain for capitalism. Someone who gave lectures to his girlfriend, Gloria, about the corruption of the American political system. And somebody who preached about the importance of the rich helping the poor. A true social justice warrior, right? And Drew in the novel, in this book, is portrayed as an idealistic young man who doesn't really have any desire to fight in a war, but who feels compelled to serve his country in some noble fashion. Now, you can read Philip Drew, Administrator. It's a piece of garbage work, but its intent, in my view, is extremely important. The book itself, at the end, or perhaps the theme of the book, once elected in office, Philip Drew begins to do what? Fundamentally change America into his image. One of Drew's first acts is to meet with all the leaders who helped him overthrow the federal government, give him an inspiring speech. And again, you can read this in the book itself, but it really echoes, in my view, or at least looks like the Barack Hussein Obama days. And Drew, in the character, began reshaping America and tossing out the U.S. Constitution with its systems of checks and balances. What is the goal today? It's the progressive left, or the left, the communist socialist left. Their goal is to really destroy the Constitution, to shred the Constitution. Barack Hussein Obama, I would argue, has done more of any person in the Oval Office to do just that. Meanwhile, those charges are being projected on President Donald Trump today. Now, I would say that something that's significant about this, when you look at Drew, look at the text. One thing that Drew wrote, and I hesitate here because this is rather complex, but Edward Mandelhaus wrote about Drew, one of his most significant acts is to bring together five great lawyers who have no objectionable corporate or private practices. And he gives them authority to define the powers of all courts, both state and federal. They have the sole power to abolish or create courts as they see fit, and to fashion their own rules of what's permitted for prosecutors and defenders to argue before the courts. Now, we see this in the court-shaping process, or we saw this with Obama and the Supreme Court. Okay? Oh my, how art imitates life, life imitates art, that is. What did we see? Why the big deal? Why the big brouhaha over Judge Kavanaugh? It had nothing to do with Judge Kavanaugh. It had everything to do with his rulings and his adherence to the Constitution. So, you look at, for example, the machinations, the mental machinations of Edward Mandelhaus as delineated in his work, Philip Drew, Administrator, and you can see the left today, the communist socialist left, kind of gravitating toward that philosophy of complete and utter subjugation of the United States to, number one, a global governance, but number two, and perhaps even more importantly, in terms of our domestic situation, shaping the court system, which explains a lot. This depth explains a lot as to why the people behind the attacks against Brett Kavanaugh were so vicious and vile, had to keep him out of the Supreme Court, and as a matter of fact, continue toward impeaching. Ultimately, their desire is to impeach Judge Kavanaugh, as crazy as that sounds, which is why the midterms are so important to the progressive socialist communist left in this country. I hope you can see the connections, or I hope I'm doing a good job explaining the connections. And then again, under Wilson, the graduated income tax, when you understand that that was part of Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto's plan for destroying the rich and centralizing power in government. Now move today, for example, or to today, or to recent, more recent history, when you had Lois Lerner and Koskinen at the IRS who were attacking or not approving conservative groups. And this goes on today as well. It is still taking place. Well, how does that relate to the graduated income tax? It gives them the authority to say who can be a 501c3 or who can, it gives them the just uber authority here. Now, you might think that this is a stretch. It's not. And it was during, by the way, it was during Wilson's first year in office that he oversaw the passage of the 16th Amendment, which did create the progressive income tax, and also the Federal Reserve System, which was codified into federal law at the end of 1913. And G. Edward Griffin has written a great book on that, The Creature from Jekyll Island, bringing all the players, some of who are still, or at least their prodigies and offspring are still with us today. But Drew decides, again, in staying with the House for a second here, he decides that the U.S. Constitution is obsolete. It needs to be modernized. What are we hearing today? Man, the playbook is the same. The concepts are the same. This is the Karl Marx Communist Manifesto on the left that we are seeing play out today. In addition to centralizing all power in the federal government, erasing state sovereignty, this Philip Drew also proposed making corporations share with the government and states part of their net earnings, equalizing the playing field, so to speak. What is being called for today, not just in the United States but globally? This connects directly to Karl Marx. Obviously, Philip Drew, in the character of Philip Drew, which was the brainchild or the product, intellectual product of Edward Mandel House under Woodrow Wilson. This is where it all began in modern times, which is why the reference to Woodrow Wilson of late. This is where it all began. The proposals that federal government establish employment bureaus in every part of the country to provide places for men and women to sign up for work. But if no work is to be had, they're gonna make work. I shall arrange that every indigent person that is honest and industrious shall be given employment by the federal, state, county, municipal government, as the case may be. This is what we saw under Obama. Well, it's at many points, and you can mentally, identify that. But Roosevelt, after Wilson, there was Roosevelt. Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration. What did he do? He created this massive government employment agency. And Obama's stimulus plans. See how there's this common thread. And by the way, Obamacare, yeah, Obama really, I mean, Philip Drew in that novel, Edward Mandel House's character Drew, had his own version of Obamacare. He created this board consisting of two physicians, a scientist, and an educator to formulate a plan to rid medical colleges and the medical profession of so-called incompetent doctors. He believed that there were too many doctors in the United States, so he wanted to reduce the numbers. And the bottom line, he wanted to take control over the medical profession and put it in the hands of unelected bureaucrats. Again, what are we seeing today? What did we see under Obama? So do you see the connection between Woodrow Wilson and today? Edward Mandel House, the Karl Rove to Woodrow Wilson. Now, I mentioned another guy. Am I clear on that so far? Lady, the studio dog looked at me, kind of gave me an okay look, so I guess we're clear. Now, I mentioned Edward Bellamy. Chances are you've never heard of this guy, but in the late 1800s and early 1900s, he was a very powerful influence for an American form of fascism. I don't know how to describe it. He called it nationalism. Now, are we not hearing nationalism today, but in the wrong form? Bellamy wrote a book, Looking Backward, 2000 to 1887. And in this book, he outlined his vision of an America that adopted this totalitarian fascist society in which the government is everything and the individual is just a product or a slave to this government. Now, in 1897, he published a sequel titled Equality. Both advocate a totalitarian government. Bellamy was brought up in New England, and he was actually raised a Christian but rejected Christianity and turned instead to the philosophies of European socialists for his worldview. He attended law school, but worked only just a short time as a lawyer. He became a writer and initially worked in the newspaper industry, but then left editorial work and began writing on his own, writing essays, short stories, novels to ultimately promote this utopian concept of an America free of capitalism, free of poverty, and no war. Now, in Looking Backward, which was set in 1887, there was a main character titled Julian West, named Julian West, a guy living in Boston. And I'm not going to get into the book itself. I don't have enough time. But it's somewhat similar to Philip DeRue Administrator. But I would urge everyone, seriously, to, if you're interested, look at the and read the book, just as you would read Philip DeRue Administrator. Read Bellamy's work. What I find interesting in Bellamy's work is specific over everything else. Remember, this is written in 1887. He envisioned an America in the year 2000 as having done away with all retail stores, where people shop in huge warehouses, where they order what they want from clerks who take cards. Again, think this is 1887 now. Take cards and swipe them and give them their products. There are characters in the book, of course, the references, the goods are the nation's. In other words, they're here for the people who want them, and the business of the clerks is to wait on people and take their orders, but it's not in the interest of the clerk or the nation to dispose of a yard or pound of anything to anybody who does not want it. In other words, what he was going for, in addition to his foreknowledge of what was, you know, taking place, or his how accurate he was about the warehouses and swiping cards. What he was saying is essentially that, everyone is being pushed to shop at a place like Sam's Club or Costco, or even Amazon now online. But it's a world where everyone must shop at places like that, except only one brand is offered for each product. Just one brand of government-approved toothpaste, as an example. And it's about the collective. In other words, state governments, in his view, state governments eliminated. Everything is eliminated, centralized. I guess that's the best way to describe it. Leading the country, even the president in his work was not elected, because Democratic elected government, governors and presidents and such, they're considered obsolete in the utopian world of 2000, this written in 1887. Instead, the president, for example, is chosen by a small group of elitists, by globalists. All right, so Edward Bellamy. Please remember that name, write it down. Edward Mandel House, write it down. And look at, if you have a chance, you can see how their works shaped the intellectuals, shaped academia, and even shaped some politics into what we see today. But worthy of pointing this out, Edward Bellamy did not like to use the word socialism to describe his political philosophy or that which he wrote. He instead used the term nationalism. And he established more than 150 nationalist clubs across the United States to promote his fascist ideas. He also began publishing The New Nation to promote his ideology. And Bellamy developed utopian fascist views early in life from traveling across Europe, especially Germany back in 1868 and 69 and such. So, during the travels, he began reading the writings of German socialists, and he was later influenced by a guy by the name of Albert Brisbane, a socialist who followed the ideology of French philosopher Charles Fourier. Anyway, in his book, Looking Backward, Bellamy actually adopted some of Brisbane's ideas. Now, Bellamy also expressed sympathy with communism while he worked for the New York Post, which he did, and actually promoted this other book, reviewed and promoted book titles such as The Communistic Societies of the United States. Anyway, very anti-capitalist. He wrote, by the way, Bellamy also wrote an introduction to Fabian Essays in Socialism. And there he wrote that socialism may be said to be the application of the democratic method to the economic administration of people. All right. Now, why did I go through this? Why did I spend the entire program talking about two guys, really obscure topics, gone, dead, long dead, but adherent to the socialist concepts, and not only adherent, but proponents of socialism? Because it is from these works, it is from the Wilson administration, specifically the Karl Rove of the Wilson administration, Edward Mandel House, and Edward Bellamy. It is from these individuals. They shaped the modern, what we see today as the progressive movement. They were the founders, essentially, of the progressive movement before the founders really founded the progressive movement, if you know what I mean. Yeah, I know that was a jumble of words, but you can see how, and it was at that time too, the effects that they had on Hollywood, on academia, have been so understated and really obscure by today's standards. Now, Bellamy's, for example, his promotion of the fascist utopian dream, had an impact and inspiration on others. Upton Sinclair, even some literary people back in the day, and even John Dewey, the socialist educator who brought totalitarian thinking into education. These are, and when you look at where we are today, these were the people. I'll tell you what, Marxist journalist, somebody by the name of Haywood Brown, was impacted by Bellamy, his work Looking Backward. That guy spent his life fighting for the destruction of free enterprise, fighting for the destruction of capitalism, and going against Christian morality in America. He was fighting, he fought with Margaret Sanger, the founder of what is now known as Planned Parenthood, for John Scopes, the teacher who taught evolution. He was at the center of the Scopes trial in Tennessee, and so on. So the point is this. Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, the fascists, the communists, and the central planners who limited or totally eradicated freedom of the individual, they disguised their evil under the pretext or under the guise of progress, and referred to themselves as, you guessed it, progressives. And often these progressives stopped progress, period. And we see examples. Look at Pol Pot of Cambodia, who killed any citizen who spoke a foreign language or anybody who had traveled outside of the nation. Virtually all intellectuals and educated citizens were eradicated in the name of progress. Now, I don't want to scare you, but this is the ultimate dream, the utopian dream of the modern day progressives. And you may say, no, I know liberals and progressives, they're not thinking that way. They might not be, but their hierarchy is. Remember what Larry Grathwohl had said before his death about the meetings he attended with Weather Underground. The fact that the Weather Underground, they were dead serious in putting conservatives, capitalists, into re-education camps and killing them if necessary. And you may say, well, that's pretty extreme. That's an extreme example. No, it's not. You know, I would say this, too. If you want additional information on fascism, progressivism, and such, Jonah Goldberg wrote a good book titled Liberal Fascism. It traces the beginnings of the progressive movement back to Edward Bellamy, back to Philip Drew and such. But Edward Bellamy, looking backward, and then forward from there, Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Wilson openly calling for a rejection of our Constitution and Bill of Rights. What are we seeing today? And this is where it all ties together. What are we seeing today? The primary theme of the progressive left, of the communists, the socialists, the fascists themselves, is they're saying, look, we have to interpret the Constitution. We have to mold the Constitution is a living, breathing document. We have to fix it. We have to modernize it. Which is why, for example, the Bill of Rights, the First and Second Amendments, which is why they are under attack today. If you understand the deeply ingrained mindset from, I mentioned two individuals and their intellectual offspring, whether it be under Obama, Van Jones, and others. They're still here in the form of a shadow government under Obama. Obama being one of the biggest collectivist agenda promoters of our time. So everything that we're seeing today is manifesting from this particular mindset. You trace it back to Bellamy. Trace it back to Wilson and his alter ego, Edward Mandel House. The writings are still applicable today among the intellectuals, the academics, and even the members of the deep state. So if you want to know the mental tactics or the mental ideology or the ideology and the mental and practical aspects of the tactics we're seeing today play out on the streets, it is from these works, inspired from these works, the end goal, the big end goal, hinging, of course, on the 2018 midterms. Perhaps that might be an overstatement. I don't think so. Get rid of the conservatives. Get rid of the Republicans in the House and the Senate. Let's regain the House and Senate. But this time, let's do it right, and let's follow the works of Bellamy. Let's follow the works of House, and let's now eradicate or change the Constitution. We can't do it through the Supreme Court, or if we can, we've got to impeach Kavanaugh, and we've got to regain our ability to stop, block further judicial appointments, which is why, President Trump has elected more federal judges to date than Obama, and soon he's going to pass all presidents in history, because he knows the importance of judicial appointments. Boy, I hope that made sense. I hope I was clear. If I was, hey, send me an email. Tell me how I'm doing. Doug@HagmanReport.com. And be sure to catch our show tonight, Hagman Report. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you heard, spread this program on social media.
The Doug Hagman Radio Show is brought to you by The Hagman Report. Tune in to The Hagman Report weekdays, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, go to HagmanReport.com. That's HagmanReport.com.